Hey, I'm Brett Podolsky, co-founder of The Farmer's Dog. We make fresh food for dogs. We started the company when we saw what a huge difference it made in my own dog, Jada, when she stopped eating ultra-processed kibble and started eating fresh, whole food. The Farmer's Dog food isn't fancy. It's just real food delivered to your door in pre-portioned packs. It's better for them and easier for you.
Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/podcast. That's thefarmersdog.com/podcast.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
A word of warning. This podcast explores graphic and disturbing stories and includes some strong language. It therefore may not be suitable for our young listeners or other folks who may find it disturbing. Hello and welcome to True Crime Daily, the podcast covering high-profile and under-the-radar cases from across the country every week. We are recording this on December 9th, 2020. I'm your host, Anna Garcia, and joining us today is former Burbank Police Lieutenant Eric Rossoff, who also runs the Campus Safety Group. Welcome back to the program, Eric.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's always a pleasure to have some time to chat with you, Anna.
Oh, absolutely. I'm really happy that you're here. We have some, as usual, some very disturbing, insane cases. But before we get to them, because it's the holidays, I don't know if you've all noticed, but I decorated for you. We wanted to talk about our own personal safety, because I think everyone is aware right now, Eric, that crime across the country is up. And we are all, as individuals, because of everything that's going on, probably feeling even more vulnerable than ever. So are there some things that we should consider in the next few weeks as we go on about our business, trying as best as possible to have a normal life?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's cycles to rises in crime. And definitely a bad economy would be one of those factors that then we see a tremendous rise in property crimes and thefts and such. And as people get more anxious about whatever situations might be coming up, then you see a rise or an uptick in crimes against people. And we're in, obviously, you know, one, if not going to be the most dramatic times in our life. And there is a horrible economy and there's an incredible amount of stress. That said, the standard tenets of safety remain kind of the same. You know, the first is just situational awareness. Be aware of your surroundings at every time. Try to eliminate places that, you know, might be expose you to being a target of some type places or circumstances that may expose you to be a target of crime. Also, because the economy has kind of changed, the way we're not necessarily going out shopping as much as things are being delivered to us pretty frequently. And we found, I've read some articles recently where law enforcement is, you know, recommending, highly recommending that neighbors form, you know, again, just within four or five houses around each other, a neighborhood watch, and maybe some type of product delivery service drop-off place. You know, that if there's a retired person like me that's home and other people do have to go to work, maybe I can accumulate or I'll watch out for people getting packages and I'll secure those packages for them until they get home. You know, because there's a lot of that happening right now, people stealing things off of porches.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've got one of those Ring video doorbells and it's got a community to it. I can't tell you how many notices I keep getting every day at all hours of the day about something being stolen from someone's house. And I have to admit, even I've made a change as well. You know, now you're not allowed to bring your own grocery bag into the supermarket, right? Because of COVID. So, and I don't need that many extra bags. So I keep saying to them, oh, just put it back in the cart and I will load it in my trunk into my bags, which I'd been doing for months. I have to tell you, Eric, in the last few weeks, I've stopped doing that. The other day, I was in a dark garage and all of a sudden I realized, for God's sakes, I'm standing here for like 5 to 10 minutes fiddling with my trunk, completely focused on moving all my groceries, the cold here, the hot there. And I thought, I'm just a sitting duck right now. So I've made that kind of a change. I'm just that much more aware. And I'm sorry to say that I have to make those kinds of changes.
Well, and I'm going to ask you, don't be sorry to say that. That's a public service announcement that you just provided for folks, is you recognized what you were doing and you recognized that under these circumstances that could be dangerous, and you made an adjustment. That's exactly what I'm talking about related to any sort of situational awareness, that as long as you fixed it, you know, now we're moving forward. But just the fact that you commented on it now, I can't imagine the, you know, how many viewers right now are thinking to myself, oh boy, I do that exact same thing. I should stop doing that. So it's a public service announcement. You did well right there.
Thank you, Eric. I appreciate that. As a crime reporter, I try to be vigilant. Well, thank you for that advice. We really appreciate it. Let's get straight into our cases today. We have, you know, oh, it's just so, they're so unbelievable. We are looking into the following. A woman who moved to Phoenix, Arizona for a fresh start at life. Can't we all really appreciate where she would have been in, you know, the space that she was holding to say, I'm moving and I'm going to make a change. And what happens? She meets a guy and she's found murdered and dismembered near the bottom of a river. Our first case, though, however, is a children's hospital nurse who was kidnapped and then held by her captor for 5 days and then transported across state lines. She was found alive, but in those 5 days, Eric, her kidnapper is accused of killing her mother while she was along on this horrible escapade. And he was eventually killed in a shootout with the FBI. That is how the nurse was freed. It's like a movie. You can't even believe that this actually happened. Authorities knew that they were dealing with a really dangerous situation when the nurse was reported missing on Thanksgiving. And also on Thanksgiving, her mother was found dead, discovered by a separate set of police. So at this point, you have two police departments saying, dear Lord, we have an abduction, we have the murder, we have the murder of her mother. So something very seriously is going on. And over the course of those 5 days, the police knew that these two crimes were connected, but they didn't know how. And of course, they couldn't completely rule out that somehow maybe the nurse was involved in all of this, right? It's a holiday, it's a murder, it's family. So let's take a look at the details of the crime. Eric, I do want to ask you before we go into the details, when you have something like this, you have two separate crimes occurring within a family, are you thinking, you know, got it, the universe of finding who may be responsible is really tiny? Because they clearly have to be related.
Yeah, generally speaking, going into it, you would think the solvability factor of this is high. That when, you know, at first we have the abduction like you talked about, and at first glance, that was a missing person. It was relatively a low priority. Someone's reporting that someone's not generally where they would normally be. And as you investigate that, there may be bits and pieces that you start to see that would be, okay, well, now it's a little bit more suspicious. Does the scene where she was last known to be, does it look like there's signs of a struggle or whatever? But relatively quickly, you fold in, right, that if I'm investigating this missing person, one of the things that I'm going to do is reach out to family members, right? And now all of a sudden, the first family member that you would reach out to would be mom, and we're finding out in another community the mother's been murdered. And now we've joined these two things together, that there's no chance that these are coincidental, that there's some type of a nexus between it. And either the missing person is in huge peril, or the missing person is complicit in a murder. And we don't know that answer, but we're working from that foundation.
Exactly. And those 5 days were incredibly long, both for the victim of this abduction and presumably she witnessed the murder of her mother, plus what police were trying to get to. Because obviously, if you have one person who's dead, there's likely the possibility of either one more being dead or that someone else is in peril. So here are the details of the crime. 45-year-old Nicole Bernowski of Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, was last seen on Wednesday, November 25th, at 6:35 p.m. This is the day before Thanksgiving. Now, in addition to being a hospital nurse, she also worked as a nurse for the Akron School District. She was reported missing by her ex-husband the next day on Thanksgiving. Also on Thanksgiving, about 2 hours south of where Nicole disappeared, her home, her mother, 69-year-old Norma Matko, is found shot to death in her home in Barnesville, Ohio. Okay? Now, if that is not horrific enough, reportedly her killer, the killer of the mother, carved some kind of symbol or word on her back, and he raped this elderly woman. So already you have not just a horrific and violent crime. Now, this is like Manson type crazy. I mean, to carve something on someone's back?
Yeah, when you start at a baseline of homicide, you know, you're about as bad as you can be. And you imagine the degrees then of not just a homicide, but the type of homicide and the psychosis that must be going on related to, as you're investigating that crime scene, who you're looking for and the type of person that you're looking for.
Right. Because this is not like, oh, I just snapped. This is not, oh, a crime of opportunity. I came in and I had to steal something, right? It's not, there's something else going on here. This takes it to a whole other level. And it's already horrific to begin with, without question. So apparently it didn't take very long for police to kind of come up with a potential suspect, even though they did not release this to the public. The FBI quickly became involved because they believed that 47-year-old James Hawley, also known as Ahmad David, was the one to kidnap Nicole. And here's the reason, because Nicole and James had dated, apparently, this is according to the Belmont County Sheriff. He's the one who said they had some type of relationship and then the relationship ended. He didn't say anything more than that at a news conference, but I think we can interpret that to be, you know, some form of dating, whether it was a short relationship, just one date, we don't know the details of it. So the sheriff made it clear that they were no longer together. To make this even a more of a small town tragedy, if you will, the same sheriff is the neighbor to Nicole's mother who was murdered. And he became emotional at a news conference once everything was solved and Nicole was rescued. Here's a clip of that.
This is a very important day for us. Excuse me for a minute because I knew him personally. We had a murder last Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, that we was informed. Just wanted to say that it was one of our local resident, Norman Matko, who I think was age 69, that was murdered. These were good people, are good people, and we live beside were neighbors. So it does come on.
Obviously, it's very hard when you know the victim of a crime. And Eric, I understand, you know exactly how the sheriff was feeling.
Yeah, listen, I'm a lifelong resident of Burbank. I was born here, raised here. I'm raising my family, you know. And as a police officer here for 31 years, but unfortunately, from time to time, you would have to respond to someone that you knew in very bad circumstances. As a matter of fact, I feel for that sheriff because I, in my own personal law enforcement experience, I remember the first time that I ever found myself like spontaneously started to cry on the job. There was a death investigation and it wasn't a homicide or anything, just a simple death investigation. And when I got to the location, it was my third grade teacher who I just adored. And I remember I talked to people and I took the information. And I went out to my car and I couldn't drive the car. I just sat there for a little bit and it just brought back this wave of emotion about this wonderful person in my life who had just passed away. So there's something about, you know, the job itself, there's a range of emotions, but especially when you're that close to the person who has had, you know, has passed away, has been murdered or anything, there's another level that you get to.
Absolutely, because you're all human. We are all human. And I think sometimes we forget that. And professionalism, you know, doesn't mean you're not allowed to be human, right?
Yeah, there's a perception, I think, of the robot police officer, you know, and I think that's the last thing in the world that any of us really want. You want someone who has compassion and empathy and also, you know, a passion for the job, no doubt. But I 100% can feel where that sheriff was coming from.
Yeah, really. It just, you can really sense what a small town it is. And presumably he would have known some of Nicole, right? It's just terribly sad. Well, this is not the end of the story, however. So here's what we believe happened. Police say that Holly, right, kidnapped Nicole in Cuyahoga Falls, and then he drove her to her mother's house and around 3 a.m. on Thanksgiving, killed the mother. Then Holly took the mother's car, took Nicole with him, and drove to Cleveland. That car was later found abandoned and set on fire. It's believed then that Holly took Nicole to Louisiana in yet a different vehicle. Okay, so now he's switching vehicles. He's constantly moving, right? He's on the move without question. Then on November 27th, that's Friday, right after Thanksgiving, Holly sent this very ominous message to his 16-year-old via Facebook. Here's the message according to police. Quote, "You get it twisted. I ain't running. I am hunting. 400 years worth of killing is my soul. Quiet before you wake up and see me, or maybe your words will send me to your brother's house." Okay, if you're 16, you're like, what the heck is going on with Dad, right? This doesn't sound right. Then Holly posts some photos on social media, some photos of himself with 2 9-millimeter pistols on Thanksgiving. And apparently those photos were taken in Nicole's apartment, placing him in Nicole's apartment. So it's possible that's where she was abducted. The FBI said that the photo was posted just hours before Holly tied up and raped and murdered Nicole's 69-year-old mother in Belmont County. Okay, so you can see how things are just escalating, right? And then he carved something on the woman's back. Authorities say that Holly shared numerous photos of himself with firearms on social media. It's like everything's escalating right now. Everything's escalating. The violence, the messaging, the photos. And he posted, quote, that he wants to kill some cops, okay? And presumably they already suspect that he has killed Mom and he has Nicole. Well, this is what I find fascinating. So federal charges are immediately issued for Holly's arrest. He was charged with federal crimes, including threatening through interstate communications, being a felon in possession of firearms. Here's what's interesting. So they issue the arrest warrant so the cops can go after him and begin the process of tracing his phone and trying to locate him. And remember, you know, in the back of their heads, they think Nicole, that he's holding Nicole, but the official purpose of this warrant is to be able to track him. Was that their roundabout way of trying to save Nicole?
Yeah, and it's actually not roundabout. It would be a standard operating procedure that in being able to obtain an arrest warrant for the homicide, you would have to get enough information in front of a judge that says there's, you know, reasonable cause to believe that this person has committed this crime of murder. The fact that he posts the pictures, we're well beyond the reasonable cause at that point. So you go the path of least resistance at then and get that warrant in hand, that arrest warrant in hand, because that arrest warrant then does open up not just the investigative part of it, but also the apprehension part that that comes later. When effect an arrest warrant, if I have that warrant in my hand, it gives me the opportunity maybe to enter an apartment, a house, a hotel room, et cetera. So the standard tactic would be as soon as I can get a piece of paper in my hand that says a judge is saying, arrest this person and bring them to us, it opens up all the rest of the investigative and apprehension avenues to us.
So as a result of that, the FBI was then able to trace his phone to a motel in Louisiana, about 100 miles north of Baton Rouge. The FBI then, so now this is Tuesday, okay? I want, you know, she's abducted either late Wednesday night, Thursday morning, we think Wednesday night. And now this is Tuesday. And the FBI moves in to arrest Holly at this motel. Of course, he refuses to go. He's not going to make this easy. So there's now a shootout at the motel. Holly, the suspect, is shot and killed. And an FBI agent is also wounded, has to go to the hospital. And the amazing thing is, Nicole is alive and safe. Shocking. That, can you imagine? I mean, bullets are flying everywhere. She's got to be so terrified besides everything she's been through the last 5 days. And she actually gets rescued in like a crazy Rambo Terminator style.
It's incredible that she wasn't struck by some sort of gunfire, including if Holly knew that, okay, now this is the end, and he'd already extracted, you know, this vengeance against her family, that he wouldn't have shot her. And she wasn't hit by stray gunfire, though it's just incredible that she survived that.
It is. And so they were in the process of reuniting her with her family, trying to get her, obviously, a lot of help. She's been seriously traumatized, and we don't know what kind of physical injuries and attacks that she may have sustained in the process of this violent five-day ordeal. What is also unknown is what happened. Like, why was the mother killed? You know, it's interesting that he allegedly, I mean, he's dead. I mean, he took Nicole, right? He kidnaps Nicole. But why did they have to go to her mother's house, drive almost 2 hours away to get to the mother's house to kill her? And I think the violent way in which that the mother was murdered leads me to believe that there was something very personal and very angry, right? He doesn't appear, he could have killed Nicole. He didn't do that, right? But he wanted to kill her mother. So I have a feeling, it's just my guess, that the motive sits somewhere in there.
There are any number of possible motives. You know, first, let's just set that line that the level of psychotic behavior, you know, that's involved in this.
Right.
It could be that part of the reason that there's no longer a relationship between he and Nicole is because the mother intervened. Who knows? These are all so tragic, but there are cases, you know, where in a domestic violence type of a thing, a jilted boyfriend or lover will shoot and kill the person that they now focus on as ruined their life or whatever. But to take her, you know, and then go to a relative's house and do what he did, there's more of like a plan there, you know, more of a deviance that gets involved in that I'm going to show you this is going to hurt you worse than being shot, you know, type of a thing. And this is what I'm going to do because you did me so wrong. I wouldn't be surprised, Anna, if we don't hear that that Louisiana isn't a spontaneous place, that once we've flipped this far and he's into it, that there may be other people, whether it's in Nicole's greater world or just other people that he feels have wronged him, that this wasn't going to end until the FBI or some other law enforcement agency apprehended him or shot and killed him as it ended.
Right. And no matter what the motive, there's no excuse for this. You can't do this, but it you know, people are always asking for the why. It's a form of trying to comprehend. It's a human reaction of trying to comprehend something that's incomprehensible. Now, even though he made some statements on social media that he clearly wanted to kill police, authorities say that they do not currently see Holly being tied to any kind of specific ideologies or groups or anything like that that may have somehow worked into this. I mean, look, I'm not going to use the word terrorism here, but he terrorized this family without question.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, we've seen this to a certain extent in other threshold cases where people have put on social media some type of connection or at least belief in an ideology, you know, of whether it's a terrorist organization or whatever it might be, but no direct nexus. They just kind of feel I'm some sort of, you know, I'm going to right all the wrongs, or I'm a jihadist or whatever it might be, but there's no other real connection. There was a case here in Los Angeles not very long ago. You probably remember it, where a police officer who had been terminated from the Los Angeles Police Department went on a rampage. And, you know, there was a
I covered that case. I covered that case.
And you remember his first target was the child of the person that he believed had done him wrong. You know, and that's a, like I said, that's a whole nother level of dangerous psychotic behavior at that point, because then there's a plan. I'm going to make you suffer in a way that you made me suffer, and I'm going to have you stay alive to watch it. That's a whole different, that's movie stuff at that point.
Right. Do you find anything extra troubling about the fact that he went on social media as part of this crime spree?
I think that actually fits into that psychosis that we're talking about, because I believe that in his mind or other people's minds like that, they think that they're communicating to the world that, you know, now it's the spotlight is on me and everybody is watching what I'm doing and it's fueling, you know, this thing. What they don't really understand is there's maybe a dozen people, you know, that are paying attention to what he's saying. And, you know, half of those or more are federal and state law enforcement, you know, that are tracking him down. So it ended up his false bravado, you know, the self-aggrandizement was actually what led police to him in the first place. You know, it wasn't his statement, you know, him putting a stamp on it, you know, okay, world, here I am. It was okay, FBI, here I am. And ended up with him being shot and killed.
Well, there are so many things that are missing, so many details about what really happened, that I hope that if information is released after a debrief with Nicole, if we get a good update, we will share that with everyone, because I think we all really want to understand this crime a lot better.
I can tell you too, I'll add into that, Anna, that the FBI will be pour over every segment of this case, because as we've discussed a couple of times now, this is a different echelon, you know, of criminal, and there's a profile in that. And they'll look for commonalities to other similar behaviors in an effort to try to direct resources when they have some common, initial clues at crime scenes as the type of person they're looking for. That whole behavioral science unit at the FBI, there'll be months and months into this case about every aspect, about, you know, every person that might have been contacted. It's a fascinating science.
And also the fact that there was a police shootout and that the suspect was killed, we can't lose sight of the fact that he also made a threat that he wanted to kill police officers. So I think that that entire shootout is going to have to be dissected to figure out who made what call and how. Plus, because you have a suspect that's dead and you have an FBI agent in the hospital who was shot.
Yeah, not knowing more about it, I would, the circumstances would certainly suggest that by the time they were in Louisiana at that motel, they felt very confident that Nicole had been abducted and wasn't complicit in the murder. Had she been complicit in the murder, general police tactics would be, we just kind of wait for them to come out. You know, we would make sure, because of his statements about shooting a police officer, we would do the best we could to control that entire environment. But if they believe they have a hostage, that I think they knew that Nicole was a hostage at that point, it changes the tactics from in law enforcement.
Now on to our second case. This is where a woman who was trying to start a new life was found killed and dismembered in a river bottom. On October 27th, Amy Ruby Ligons was reported missing after her family said that they hadn't heard from her for 6 days. Cops initially identified 61-year-old Timothy Sullivan as a potential suspect, and here's why. Because when Ruby moved to Arizona from Illinois over the summer, again, this is all part of that fresh start, right? Everything's going to be better. She met Timothy Sullivan through a friend, and the two started dating. But during their relationship, Timothy Sullivan allegedly assaulted Ruby, and it turns out that he had a violent criminal history of domestic violence, which we will detail in just a bit. So, again, most people are killed by people they know, right? Not saying automatically that he's going to be a suspect, but he was certainly on the short list. And then what happened solidified his position to be moved up to suspect number one.
Yeah, the standard operating procedure, every homicide investigation or missing person investigation actually is, you know, back in my day, years ago, it was you found the phone book, the personal phone book of the missing person or the victim of a homicide. And 80% of the time, you were going to find the name of the person responsible or at least someone who was going to give you important information inside that book. Today, I imagine it's cell phone records. You know, I've replaced all that, but it's the first step of trying to locate somebody or identify a suspect in a homicide.
Well, police say that Timothy went to great lengths to cover up his crime and dispose of Ruby's body, but in doing so, he actually left a trail of evidence. So police initially contacted Sullivan, and they say that he was living with an ex-girlfriend in Scottsdale, Arizona. They interviewed him about a week before Ruby Ligon's body was actually discovered. Sullivan allegedly told police that he had met Ruby before. Yeah, okay, they dated a little bit, but they really were not in a relationship. That's what he said. So this is when the evidence starts coming out. Authorities say that they found a bottle of bleach, latex gloves, a scrub brush, bedding, and a duffel bag inside of Sullivan's car at that Scottsdale address where he was staying with his ex-girlfriend. Items in the car, as well as items found during a sweep of Sullivan's property, plus a search of his cell phone records, led to the discovery of Ruby's body, according to investigators. Investigators searched the home with a search warrant. This was the Scottsdale home. And that's where they found something bizarre. They say the backyard area was covered in mulch and that there were burned pieces, which were later identified as human hair, women's clothing, and a bracelet. Okay, how often do we see that the killers try to burn the bodies of their victims? We see this all the time.
It's pretty common in some sort of, you know, aftermath of, oh my gosh, what just happened, or I've done this, how am I going to hide the fact that I've done this? And then that usually ends up in some incredibly clumsy or even multiple clumsy attempts to cover it up.
So as a result of searching and mining his cell phone records and where he had been through his GPS, they located Ruby. So on November 17th, part of Ruby's body was found near River Bottom in Phoenix. Her body showed obvious signs of trauma, obviously. On November 25th, Sullivan was taken into police custody. And according to the records, Sullivan allegedly admitted to killing Ruby after they had an argument. He said she was yelling at him and that he snapped. Okay, I find this interesting, and here's why. Because ultimately, he doesn't get charged with murder one. He gets charged with second-degree murder. So, I mean, are they buying this whole, like, fit of passion, snap thing? This always drives me crazy, honestly. It really does. There is a woman who is dead. Her body parts are scattered all over the place. She clearly died a hideous, violent death. How is this not murder one?
It's when the case arrives at the district attorney's office, the district attorney, you know, will usually take a look at it and said, what is my most likely conviction? And unfortunately, and who's to say, you know, right or wrong to it, but the district attorneys that I've worked with in the past would generally, on homicide cases, will generally charge what they would consider charge up and say, we can prove second degree murder here. which might be a heat of passion type of murder. However, I'm an advocate for the victim here. I don't have the victim's side of the story other than the trauma and, you know, the other forensic evidence that I might be able to obtain. So I'm going to file a first degree murder, and then we'll let this play out, you know, because that's the only way at this point I can advocate for the victim.
I agree with you.
But again, in any district attorney is generally a political position, and I don't know specifically in Arizona or for that county what the filing criteria might be. There may have been some sort of an arrangement that was worked out with the district attorney and the investigating officers at the time of the confession, you know, I don't want to speculate too much on that, but I would agree with you, Anna, that it just seems a little bit out of place that based on the circumstances, you would take what was already in your hand versus filing the charge that actually advocates for the victim.
Well, I think what I am willing to believe here is that he cooperated and admitted, and if that's the case, that there was some kind of deal and could have also helped with the location of all of Ruby. I suppose that that's a negotiation that could have taken place. We don't know. We're just speculating here. So Sullivan went on to say to investigators that he choked her to death, and then he left her body in her Chandler apartment for 2 days. This may be the negotiation, meaning he's telling them how it happened, where he did it, where she is, and maybe that's why it's a slightly lesser charge. So then he tells the cops that he wrapped her body in a tarp and then he buried her in the backyard there in Scottsdale, Arizona. But the idiot became worried. Yes, this is what he's worried about, right? He was so worried, Sullivan, that he allegedly exhumed the body, and then he decided he's going to chop up Ruby's body because that way it'll be easier to get rid of her in separate plastic bags inside trash cans throughout the area. So Ruby was chopped up and dispersed in multiple locations, not just what they found of Ruby in the bottom of the river. Ultimately, it was dental records that were used to identify Ruby's remains. Investigators say that Sullivan indicated that his actions were spontaneous and heinous in nature. Oh, isn't that lovely that he actually agreed that it was heinous? You know what it is? It always gets to me at my core. I always feel that our justice system seems to be tilted so much more away from the victim, right? It's always a horrible process for the victim. Look, there can be no justice. We can't get Ruby back, but it just drives me crazy. That's what bugs me to my core.
Yeah, there seems to be an ebb and flow, right? There'll be some sort of political sweep through that would say and I'm not advocating for one side or another as much as just observing, and from my seat in a police car observing, there'll be a push towards more restorative justice and restorative, types of systems. And then there seems to be an ebb and flow where the restorative almost always gets followed by a little bit of a spike in certain types of crimes. And then all of a sudden we'll get things like the Victim's Bill of Rights, you know, and we're going to three strikes laws. And at any given time, there doesn't ever seem to be a balance in the middle, at least in my 31 years of law enforcement, that sometimes absolutely restorative is the way that we should be approaching some of these things. But then there needs to be an accountability and a punitive aspect, you know, and murder would seem to always be one of those punitive things, you know, that and regardless of most of the circumstances that there is, we seem to be in an area now that it's almost like a rubber stamp process, and we have a dead person at the, you know, on the front side of that process.
Well, Eric, here's why I take such exception here and why I'm just at my core so angry at this Sullivan guy, because he has a violent history against women. He nearly killed another woman, according to a former victim of his. And he was out on probation when he did this to Ruby. Okay? So that makes me very angry that this could have been avoidable. Let's look at Timothy's background. So Susan Davidson of Phoenix, Arizona, told TV station KPNX that Sullivan tried to kill her in 2014. Now, she presented to the television station the police record, the photos that were taken at the hospital. She had massive bruises on her neck, her eye. She lost her teeth. It was a beating like none other. She survived. He punched her more than 20 times and choked her, resulting in that punctured eye. He took a plea deal. This is a man with experience with plea deals. He took a plea deal for aggravated assault and was sentenced to 2.5 years behind bars and 4 years of probation. Timothy was still on probation when he started dating Ruby. This is why I'm so angry.
And it could be part of the reason that the district attorney was at a second-degree murder because, again, not being familiar with the Arizona Penal Code, but generally speaking, if you commit a similar crime while you're on probation, there are certain sentencing structures that are taken off the table, like probation is no longer on the table. And low term, a lot of these cases will have predetermined sentencing. There's what's called a low term, a mid term, and a high term. And if you're on probation and do it again, you lose the low term. You know that. So they know if they successfully prosecute him for second degree murder, whether it's a plea bargain or a jury trial, that he's going to be in jail for say 12 years. You know, now, again, I'm not advocating for that, but I understand that that might be part of the filing process, that they know that he is going to be locked up for quite some time.
So if I understand you correctly, that because of the circumstances, he will be in prison for so long that ultimately it could be equivalent to almost a murder one charge.
Generally speaking, if you're on probation and you commit the same crime, the sentencing is much more harsh. Okay. You know, for any sort of a sentence for a similar type of a crime. Now, he committed a murder, and you know, it's there are advocacy. The reason there are advocacy groups for these domestic violence types of issues is I saw those same pictures that you were describing and you were showing, and they go into a system, a court system, and 2 years in probation. And generally the probation, not knowing, but generally probation would be like anger management classes, you know, type of a thing. And maybe some people, you know, they come through that process and they come out the other side and they're better folks for it. However, the risk of a man that, number one, a man that would strike a woman, much less multiple times and, you know, break her orbital socket and choke her to where there's a visit. I'm thinking we're, anger management probably isn't, you know.
Too far. Yeah. I got no sympathy for this guy. Yeah. Timothy Sullivan has been charged with second degree murder, and I hope they lock him up for life and they throw away the key. I got no sympathy here for him.
Yeah, I'm joining your club on that. It's, I suppose we can look at it like he got another bite at the apple, and this is what he did as a result. And I have zero sympathy here.
Zero. In our comments section today, we actually have an update on a murder that outraged so many of you. It's the murder of Fort Hood soldier Vanessa Guillen. The Army finally took action and has fired or suspended 14 people at Fort Hood as a result of an independent investigation into violence on that base, including murders, sexual assaults, and a rash of suicides. 25 soldiers assigned to Fort Hood have died due to suicide, homicide, or accidents, and including the bludgeoning death of soldier Vanessa Guillen. That is an awful lot of violence taking place on a military base, presumably with enormous security measures. Now, the case of Vanessa, in case you don't remember, she was missing for about 2 months before her remains were found. A fellow soldier was ultimately charged with her murder, and this is the part that upset the community, absolutely upset her mother, upset us all. In those 2 months, base officials stalled the investigation to the point that federal authorities had to get involved. There was a congresswoman who was protesting outside the base trying to reason with the military officials to help the local police solve this case. They stalled the investigation. The family says that there was a cover-up because Vanessa had confided in her family that she was being sexually harassed by her superiors, right? And that when she told other soldiers on the base, they too had suffered sexual abuse at the hands of their superiors, yet nothing was done. So I guess you could say that this is finally a bit of cleaning house at Fort Hood. But what upsets me about this is that it really is too little, too late, because for 2 months, that family was twisting, trying to get information, and they refused. Had the authorities on the base at least cooperated early on, look, sadly, Vanessa still would have been murdered. But the point is, she would have been found so much sooner if the military base officials had cooperated in this investigation. This one gets me so upset.
Yeah, there's volumes and volumes of literature and classes that you can attend, that in law enforcement we attend, about culture. You know, the culture within an agency, the culture at a base. And that culture is established by the people on the top. And there are the ones that are going to say, listen, we have rules and we expect you to meet the expectations that are in these rules. Everybody gets treated with dignity and respect, you know, that we won't tolerate any sort of harassment. There'll be quick repercussions if you violate the expectations. Well, in a dysfunctional culture, the people at the top either turn a blind eye to or just totally disregard the rule. And then as soon, the higher you go in the organizational chart that aren't, you know, holding people accountable, specifically themselves, that just permeates then down through to the person with the boots on the ground. It happens in law enforcement. It happens in the military. It happens in corporate America. You know, that once that culture is established, number one, it can be incredibly difficult to penetrate, as we see here with the fort. But even think about all what we're learning from local law enforcement. You know, part of the angst about local law enforcement is the police officers all seem to be behind a very big, thick wall, and the public really doesn't know what's going on, and that whole transparency movement. And part of that is sometimes, you know, there are protections in place, but other times it's the agency itself. I don't want you to see my dysfunction. Because the larger the gap between the expectation, that's the safest place for everybody to be, and the application where the boots are on the ground, the larger that gap is, the more dangerous it is for everybody that's on that base, or the more dangerous it is for everybody in that police department.
Well, so this 25 soldiers, homicide, suicide, accidents. That is a lot of human life. That is a lot of human life. So I think it's the right thing to do is to clean house. I hope that that's enough of a cleaning. I don't know if 14 people on a massive military base is enough, but it's a start. It's a good reaction. And I think some of you also agree because here are your comments. Aisha M. writes, sketchy place. You'd think it's safer on a base, but obviously not. Exactly. That's what Vanessa's family thought. Susan C., something is terribly wrong over there. Need to investigate more. I agree. Not done yet. And Joy A. writes, this is insane. Here's the other story. This one's crazy because we need one. Let's end on something. an upstate New York mayor, apparently the target of a sting operation, ends up throwing crack cocaine out of the car window in an effort to get rid of the evidence. Because if you throw it out, then you can get away with the crime. The mayor of Messina, New York, was arrested for allegedly throwing crack cocaine out of his car after failing to pull over during a traffic stop. Agents from an undercover operation in association with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, oh, they were watching this mayor, all right, pulled over Timmy Courier's vehicle on suspicion of drug sales and possession. Cops say that they saw the mayor throwing out about a gram of crack from the passenger window, so they must have been coming up on the driver's side and he quick threw it out the other side. Ha-ha, they'll never find it. Yeah, he must have been under the influence when he came up with this plan. Timmy Courier, here's the best part, used to be the police chief of Messina for more than 20 years before being elected mayor in 2014 and then being reelected in 2018. The mayor of Messina, everybody?
Yeah.
Nothing we can say.
Well, I think had he thought it through, it would have been, boy, am I glad to see you guys. I was just bringing this down to the police station to turn it in because I found it someplace. But he wasn't quite that quick to come up with it. But
well, that's clever, Eric, but I wouldn't have bought that one either.
I've run into that, made a traffic stop where somebody had narcotics in the car. And when I walked up to the window, they said I was just on my way down to the police station to turn this in.
Wow. What a good doobie.
Yeah, well, I'm going to take you and the narcotics to the police station with me.
There you go. I'll give you a ride. And Diane T. writes, every person with high rank should be drug tested periodically. I bet there's a lot more. I think that's probably true. And then Kim L. writes, Merry Christmas, Timmy. Yeah, Merry Christmas indeed. And with that, that is the end of this episode. Eric, we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's always I love it when you tell us your personal stories. I really do. That helps, I think, understand situations and just makes it, you know, that much more human. So thank you for that. Where can people find you on social media or your website?
Thank you. The campussafetygroup.org. We have recently restructured into a nonprofit organization. And we're about to roll out a pretty robust marketing campaign to help schools be more safe.
Excellent. Excellent. I wish you a very safe and happy holiday season. You can find me all on social media at Anna G News, Anna with one N. And I love to hear your comments. I can't wait to hear your comments on today's episode. As always, you can find our content on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and of course on YouTube. And you can get updates by subscribing to our newsletter at truecrimedaily.com. It's a great crime family, as I like to say. We are almost 4.2 million strong, and I just love this community of people. So until next week, this is True Crime Daily, the podcast. I'm your host, Anna Garcia. And as we always say, don't do crime.